Debt ceiling talks keep going on in Washington.
As the president's former top economist warns about the consequences of a U.S. debt default.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for checking out the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It is Friday. Happy Friday, Steve.
Happy Friday.
It is July the 1st.
First day of the month. Coming up on the podcast, the showdown between the White House and Congress headlines a new month and a new quarter in business.
An anti-bribery law in Britain that's arguably one of the toughest in the world.
And later, oh, the ridiculous pictures of three Chinese officials hovering over a road.
Quite the sight to behold, and we will get right in on the action all ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
The White House now says July 22nd is the deadline for Congress to agree to a deal to raise the nation's $14.3 trillion debt ceiling. The Obama administration had said August 2nd was the drop-dead date to avoid a default, but officials now say it'll take Congress a couple weeks to dot the I's and cross the T's. We're going to talk about that and much more with former Treasury Secretary and President Obama's former Economic Council Chief Larry Summers. That's coming up.
We'll get to that in just a few minutes. First, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is with us from Washington with an update on those talks. Good morning, Nancy.
Hey, Steve.
All right. The latest on the debt talks now?
Well, the White House says a deal to raise the debt ceiling now has to be reached by July 22nd. The thinking is that would give Congress enough time to pass it before the August deadline. The president has talked a lot about scaling back a tax break for companies that buy corporate jets. Republicans like Senator Marco Rubio of Florida say the president is exaggerating how much that would save.
It's not only misleading. I think, quite frankly, it's disappointing. It's class warfare, and it's the kind of language that you would expect from a leader of a third world country, not the president of the United States.
That doesn't sound promising, Nancy. Is there a
No.
plan B then?
Well, there's talk of a scaled back deal. It would raise the debt ceiling to get us through the next 7 months and include budget cuts of about $1 trillion that would avoid a default next month. Larry Summers was one of President Obama's top economic advisors. He told Marketplace there's no way leaders in Washington will allow the U.S. to default.
They want to avoid Lehman Brothers on steroids. But I think it's essentially inconceivable that there will be a default.
And, Steve, another thing the White House wants the markets to believe is unconceivable, that Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner might be leaving. There were rumors to that effect yesterday until Geithner said he'd stay for the foreseeable future.
And those were his words. All right. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer. Nancy, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, the debt ceiling talks may even continue into next week when Congress was supposed to be on recess. That recess has been canceled. Not a great way for those lawmakers to start a new month or for Wall Street to start a new quarter.
We're going to bring in Jill Schlesinger now, editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch, who joins us on Fridays to talk about the current state of the economy. She's going to talk about this quarter and the last quarter as well. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So Congress is continuing these debt ceiling talks with the White House. How much is that going to weigh on that new quarter that starts today?
Well, of course, it's important, but the traders and economists that I talk to believe that there's going to be a deal because the stakes are just too high if there's no agreement. The real big question for the next quarter is whether the economy is going to pick up more steam, and consumers are obviously looking for an improvement in jobs, housing, and lower food and gas prices.
I want to talk a little bit, Jill, about the quarter that just wrapped up, the second quarter of the year. I know the stock market has been on a bit of a tear lately, especially the past 4 or 5 days. How did we do in quarter number two?
You know, there was a lot of bad news, the effects of the Japanese earthquake, unrest in the Middle East, debt problems in Greece, and only about 2% growth here in the U.S. But stocks did okay. The Dow squeaked out a gain. S&P 500 and NASDAQ down a little bit. Both are up 4.5% a year. And oil, which peaked at $114 a barrel during the quarter, fell 10.5%. And gas prices are almost exactly where they were 3 months ago.
Oil's trading, I think, about $94 right now. All right. Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch. Jill, thanks.
Great to be with you.
To Minnesota now, where as of this morning, the government there is shut down. State lawmakers failed to reach a budget deal. Chris Lowe is off this week. We're joined instead by Elizabeth Dunbar, who is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. She is with us from St. Paul. Good morning.
Good morning.
So is everything shut down in Minnesota this morning?
Well, only the most essential services are still going. So like state patrol, healthcare, but about 60% of state employees are not working. So most of the government offices are shut down today.
And do those 60% not working, does that save the state a lot of money?
Well, I've been doing a little reporting on this, and no one has told me that this will save money. The state is losing revenue from things like the lottery, state parks, and there are a lot of costs associated with delays. So construction is a great example. If there are projects out there that are delayed, those construction contractors are going to go seek penalties from the state later on. And then there's also some worry about the long-term reputation of the state and whether the shutdown could affect the state's credit rating or standing among those rating agencies.
The same kinds of things we're seeing at the federal level. Elizabeth Dunbar, reporter with Minnesota Public Radio, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Asian shares were mostly higher today, although stocks in China slipped after news that Chinese production in June grew, but at the slowest pace in more than 2 years. We got word this morning, too, from Thomson Reuters and the University of Michigan. They do a consumer sentiment index. While Americans are still wary about the economy and the amount of money they'll be spending in the coming months. Consumer sentiment in that index was down in June.
And, Steve, the story we talked about the other day, the NBA lockout, well, it has happened. Players and owners were unable to reach a deal on revenue sharing and salaries. We've got that story and more numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We are also on Twitter at Marketplace Radio. I'm on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson.
And my address is at Radio Chico.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Well, as we mentioned at the outset of the podcast, debt talks are still going on, and they may be going on for some time. We're going to talk about that and more with Larry Summers. During the Clinton administration, he was the Treasury Secretary, and until late last year, he was President Obama's top economic advisor. Now he is a professor at Harvard. Larry Summers, welcome to Marketplace.
Glad to be with you.
Well, let me start by asking you about the debate that's going on over the debt ceiling in Washington. Is it keeping you up at night?
No, it's not keeping me up at night because I believe that ultimately reason will prevail. There is no alternative to the government meeting its obligations. My daughters and I may have a disagreement about how much they spend at college and who should pay for their spending. We don't have the option of not paying the Visa bill.
Do you think that the lawmakers are going to go right up to the limit, though, with the debate?
I wouldn't be surprised if this gets pretty far along. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a moment of tension that served to remind everybody how cataclysmic the consequences would be if there was to be a default. But I think it's essentially inconceivable that there will be a default.
Well, play out the scenario if there is a default. Why should people be calling their lawmakers and telling them not to let this go right up to the limit?
Because they want to avoid a version of the Lehman Brothers catastrophe of 2008 on steroids. Because they don't want to see the buck broken on money market funds and the ensuing financial panic. Because they don't want to live with the consequences for their purchasing power of a crash in the dollar. Because they don't want to live in a nation that is no longer a nation of law that meets its obligations. For those reasons and many more, we all have an enormous stake in doing the elementary and the obvious thing and meeting our debt obligations.
It seems like Republicans are successfully keeping tax increases off the table when it comes to getting the budget in balance in Washington or in states like here in California. Do you think that they have won that argument for now, for years to come?
I don't think we know yet what the form of an ultimate agreement will be, either what the form of an agreement will be in the short run that carries us past the debt limit, or in the longer term when we reconcile our spending with our revenue capacity. All of us want to pay less in taxes. The question is whether we can bring spending down in acceptable ways that, two, the level of current revenue collections. And that's what's going to be debated for some time to come. And I don't think the question of where that debate is going to end is at all clear right now.
Let's talk about economic growth. You have said that China is one of the biggest potential impediments to growth. What are you worried about specifically?
I worry about a number of things with respect to growth. Most profoundly, I worry about lack of demand in the United States. That means that factory capacity is unused, means that buildings sit empty, and means that too many people are unemployed. And I look for measures that will serve to promote the level of demand in the United States. That's why using this moment to repair our infrastructure is so important. That's why I believe that the payroll tax cuts that put money in people's pockets and increase employers' incentive to hire are so important. And that's why I believe that opening foreign markets and promoting U.S. exports, which creates more demand, is so important. And China is obviously an important part of that story.
Well, you mentioned payroll taxes. You recently called for a new stimulus in the form of a payroll tax cut. But it's been reported over and over again that within the Obama administration, when you were in the administration, you were actually on the side of a smaller stimulus back in 2009.
Not accurately. Not accurately.
That's not true. You weren't pushing for a less than $1.2
trillion. No, those are, I mean, it's a much more complicated story, but those reports are not accurate. It was my judgment as an economist that there was no danger of doing too much stimulus and that one should achieve as much stimulus as possible. There were a set of political calculations having to do with what the Congress could accept that were mostly determined by the president's political advisors and ultimately by the president, which pointed towards the size of the program that was ultimately passed. But the economic advice that I gave was that the stimulus program should be as large as it could be.
Do you think it was too small in the end?
I think in the end we would have been better served if there had been more push to the economy. We would have been better served if the measures that the president put forward in the fall of 2009 for expanded infrastructure investment, for expanded support for state and local governments that passed through the House had also passed the Senate. But the choices that were made in a given political context. And I think given the slender margins of one vote by which the Recovery Act was passed, I suspect an effort to push it to a higher level might well have backfired and resulted in legislation not passing. And at that moment, that would have had catastrophic consequences in terms of depression.
Well, politics aside, do you think there's anything that the administration should have done differently in the midst of the financial crisis or the depths of the recession?
I don't know what you mean by politics aside. Administrations exist in a political context. I've indicated that I think that the imperative was to push the economy forward. I think the administration was successful in achieving as large a fiscal program as was possible in the political environment they faced. That it would have been desirable if a still larger fiscal program could have been passed.
How would you describe President Obama's economic philosophy?
I think he's a deeply pragmatic economic thinker. He recognizes that the key to any society is the success of its middle class. He's focused on improving opportunities for the middle class. He wants to look at experience around the world and see what works best and pursue that. He's neither an ideologue who believes in untrammeled free markets, nor an ideologue who believes that everything is best done by government. But I would describe his economic philosophy as supremely pragmatic, and I think it was a successful philosophy. There was a very real chance of depression in the winter of 2009, and that was avoided. It didn't have to be avoided, but much like the Cuban Missile Crisis, where it's not that anything great happened in October of 1962, but disaster was avoided. In the same way, the policy package that the president put forward was successful in preventing the Great Recession from becoming a second Great Depression.
Once we get past this debt ceiling debate, what would you advise the president is the next most important economic thing to focus on?
Oh, I think it's got to be job creation and demand. And that goes back to tax policy. That goes back to infrastructure. That goes back to promoting exports. That goes back to assuring financial adequacy for state and local governments. That goes back to promoting business confidence.
Do you think that manufacturing jobs are going to be a big part of the U.S. economic future?
Manufacturing has a crucial role. The number of jobs in manufacturing is inherently limited by the spectacular productivity growth of manufacturing, just as the number of jobs in farming has been limited by the spectacular productivity growth that has taken place in farming. We want to have as strong a manufacturing sector as we possibly can, but the reality is that right now only about 5% of American workers are engaged directly in manufacturing production. Many of those in the manufacturing sector work in advertising or marketing or finance or distribution. And so starting with 5%, a number that has trended downwards over 40 years, we have to be realistic about not seeing that as the primary avenue for future job creation.
There have been a lot of stories recently about the U.S. dollar losing its place as the world's primary reserve currency. Do you see that as something that will not last for more than another couple of decades?
It's very hard to see out beyond the last couple of decades. What I'm struck by is that in time of economic trouble, even when the economic trouble has originated in the United States, investors tend to come to the dollar rather than go from the dollar. And that's a reflection of structural features, the great liquidity of dollar markets, and it's also a reflection of, frankly, the weakness of the alternatives, given the problems that the Japanese economy has had for two decades now, given the possibilities looming of defaults in Europe, given that the Chinese restrict in all sorts of ways access to the renminbi. The dollar remains a very preferential alternative.
Finally, you're back at Harvard now. Anything you miss about being in the middle of the storm in the administration?
I'm enjoying the fact that you can go a full day when you're not working in Washington without a moment of intense frustration. And that's been very satisfying for me, and I've felt able to keep in close touch with my former colleagues and get my views in there. So I'm very happy with the opportunity I now have to think about longer range questions.
Larry Summers, former head of the National Economic Council, now back at Harvard. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now to the Marketplace Global perspective. Today, a new anti-bribery law takes effect in the UK.
The British government says it's the most draconian anti-corruption measure in the world, but some folks in the US might disagree with that. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The new British law looks severe, up to 10 years in jail and an unlimited fine for giving or receiving a bribe in Britain or abroad. A company can be prosecuted even if one of its subcontractors offers a kickback. It does seem pretty rigorous.
Very rigorous, very scary on paper. But what will matter much more is what happens when they begin to enforce.
Alexandra Rogge of the US anti-corruption group Trace doubts that the new British law will turn out to be as tough as the British government claims.
And whether they really have the resources to investigate cases outside the country. It's a question of both resources, of course, and political will.
The main British body that investigates bribery has just had its budget cut. And there are lingering doubts about Britain's commitment to crack down on corruption, especially in the murky world of arms dealing.
Even in recent conflicts, the only way to guarantee destruction of a target in the air was to
engage. Britain sells some $5 billion worth of weapons every year. 5 years ago, the UK's biggest arms company, BAE, was under investigation for allegedly bribing the Saudi royal family. Under pressure from the Saudis, the British government halted the probe. Neil Stansbury advises British companies on how to stamp out bribery.
BAE investigation and the way the British government stopped it is shameful and embarrassing. So that has been a big black mark on the British enforcement.
US campaigner Alexandra Rogge claims it's highly unlikely the Department of Justice would cave in under Saudi pressure. Worldwide, she says, the US is perceived to be tougher on corruption.
We talk to companies and say, these are companies in Europe, companies in Asia, companies operating in Africa, which law they fear the most, even with this very draconian UK Bribery Act coming into effect. And it's invariably the US law.
But Britain may have slightly less need of an anti-bribery law than the US. According to Transparency International, the Brits are seen as marginally less corrupt than Americans. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There are some changes coming today to the federal Pell Grant program, which helps low-income students pay for college. Students going to college year-round will no longer be able to get a second Pell Grant to pay for summer classes. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
The year-round Pell program was just a few years old. It was meant to help low-income students finish their degrees faster by taking summer classes. Brian Moran is interim president of the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities.
Students right now are demanding year-round education. They're not looking to take time off during the summer. So we find this to be very, very unfortunate for our students.
The alternative, though, was to reduce the maximum Pell Grant for all students. It's around $5,500 a year. Lauren Asher is president of the Institute for College Access and Success, a nonprofit advocacy group.
Preserving the maximum Pell will help protect college affordability for those who need it most.
Asher says even with significant increases over the years, the maximum grant still only covers about a third of the cost of attending a public four-year college full-time. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
To Santa Monica, California, Steve, your old home, where somebody else's old home, too, James Whitey Bulger, the notorious mobster.
I live just a few blocks away from him.
Well, you know, I've always wondered about your past.
Whatever.
He was obviously recently arrested after years on the run, but now his $1,100 a month rent-controlled apartment near the beach has become a very hot property.
Santa Monica.
Yeah,
that would have been nice. He got a bargain.
Well, one realtor says the influx of queries about the apartment from potential renters compares to the calls that came in about O.J. Simpson's house.
Oh, in Brentwood, yes.
That's right.
Yes.
A couple of caveats, though. Yeah. First of all, the rent control, that will not exist for the next tenant, so it'll go up quite
yeah,
a bit.
I'm sure.
The other thing is the $800,000 in cash that authorities found stashed in the walls of the apartment.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that's gone.
Yeah, that's probably all out of there.
New York State today is set to move forward on a plan to allow fracking. That's the controversial way of getting natural gas by shooting chemicals underground. Environmentalists say fracking will contaminate the region's groundwater. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports that the New York plan could be construed a couple of different ways.
Initial reports suggested yes, industry victory, yes to fracking in New York. Then the state issued a press release.
What it is a different flavor of no.
Analyst Kevin Book is with Clearview Energy.
They've ruled out any private lands that feed into the New York watershed, and they've also excluded all of the state lands for fracking. They've cut out a lot of the very desirable real estate.
Fracking, or hydraulic fracturing, is in its cliche form a game changer. Oil and gas companies say it unlocks a domestic energy source for decades. Critics aren't sure it's safe. And governments from Maryland to Quebec to France are all debating it. Consultant Ray Perryman says the New York lesson for companies is compromise and engage the public.
And I think the ones that are successful in doing that, that take the lead on doing that, are going to get more cooperation. They're going to find a more friendly regulatory environment.
Up next in New York, 2 months of public comment. Any drilling will wait till then. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, local officials in one Chinese town wanted to show that they were working diligently to inspect and approve a new highway. So on the city's website, they published this photo showing the officials on the job and on the highway.
Yeah.
Yeah? except they didn't use a real photograph. Instead, the city used a picture of these three high-ranking officials digitally altered to look like they were standing on the road. So imagine just cropping that in, photoshopping them out of another picture and putting them on this road. There are no shadows. There's no depth to see. It looks ridiculous. Someone didn't do a very good job, obviously, and the three men look like they're actually floating over the road. Some folks, Jeremy, are calling it the worst Photoshop job in internet history.
Wow.
I mean, that's crazy.
Something.
It's pretty bad. And people are now Photoshopping these guys, these three Chinese men, on all kinds of pictures. There's one of them on the moon. There's another next to President Obama. This one guy is standing on the scale. It's amazing. You can see that picture and many more. And even one that we did, Jeremy, you and I are in a picture on the website marketplace.org.
I was wondering what that was about.
Yeah. Why do you want to take
when
a picture of me?
When you made me take a picture this morning. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.